You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Justin Wantoku ingoa. E whakaronga ana koe ki te waia marunga irirangi pōho mō tēnei rā, te rā whitu a whiringa anuku. Kia ora, you're tuned into the Thursday Wire here on 95BFM. And this is the Thursday Wire for today, October 7th, and I'm Justin Wong, your host. E haere ake nei, coming up on the show today, we have our usual chats with Health Minister Andrew Little on what's happening within the Labour Party, as well as Radio Adelaide's Zoe Canandis on Neighbourhood Watch, international desk reports on the German federal election almost 2 weeks ago, and voting age and parliamentary terms could be on the cards for change in the government's electoral law review. As usual, he aha ofakaro, let me know what you think. Tuku pātuhi mai, you can text me on 5395 or wai mai rane, call me on 309-3879. Ko wā e waere waere, e ahi ana koutou te whakarongo ki ēne kōrero anō hei pakihiri rokiroki mārunga i te paitukutuku o irirangi poho. Me haere ki 95BFM ira kati.com. As usual, you can catch all these stories and other shows on via Becast on the 95BFM website. I tēnei wā tonu. Now let's head into the show.
Now it's time for our weekly chat with Labour MP Andrew Little.
This week with Health Minister Andrew Little, I asked him about the roadmap out of Alert Level 3 now that Auckland is on Step 1 out of the three-step process. I began by asking him whether the roadmap means Cabinet has abandoned the elimination strategy.
I think it's just an acceptance that with vaccination levels at the level they are now, which is still not high enough, but getting up there, and with the way the Delta variant has manifested itself in communities, that the critical objective now is to do everything we can to keep as many people as possible safe, that if there is ongoing infection, that maximum number of people are vaccinated, and therefore that any pressure that might otherwise go on the health system is minimised to the greatest extent possible. So, look, I think we've accepted that we're not going to get down to zero cases in this particular outbreak. The Delta variant has proven itself to be, so contagious, so quick. It is now getting into communities who are more transient, who and kind of less compliant with social mores, and that is having an impact on how we manage it. But we're substantially through a vaccination campaign that is about improving safety for everyone. We just have to now really get to the highest vaccination level that we can to make sure as many people as possible are safe.
But is it too early to move on? Because, as you know, Māori and Pacifica vaccination rates are not high enough. And to be honest, there isn't a lot of guidance given to other vulnerable communities like those immunocompromised.
Yeah, so look, in terms of Māori and Pacific, there's a lot of work going on to really push the outreach to the hard to reach parts of those communities. So if you have a look at the age bands, you look at Māori over 55, for example, actually the vaccination level there is pretty comparable to the rest of the population. It's once you get down to younger age bands where it's become problematic. And that reflects, I think, some of the communities where people are and needing to really push out into those. Likewise with Pacific communities, a lot of these are families and households and whānau who frankly have bigger priorities because it's just getting through day to day, surviving, getting food on the table, getting everybody looked after, and that is their priority. So we have to make sure that our vaccination program understands that and adapts to it and accommodates it. There's still plenty to do, but there is real effort going on to get into those communities.
I want to talk about the roadmap itself now. People we have spoken to for the past couple of days found the details, frankly, confusing around even though if they can meet their friends and family outdoors, there is still a little bit of confusion around whether masks and social distancing is needed. But do you understand the restrictions yourself?
Because Cabinet approved them. It is a bit, it probably will be a bit confusing because it is kind of trying to keep people in as close as possible to something like level three, because actually just minimizing the movement of people is the best thing we can do to control infection spread. On the other hand, we know that it's been a long time, particularly for folks in Auckland, and people are losing their patience, in some cases losing their rag. And that is a reality. That affects people's behaviours. People become less willing to kind of observe those basic precautions. So it is about trying to manage the realities of minimising infection spread, but also accepting the reality of where people are psychologically, you know, on an average sort of basis. So we are saying, look, let's free things up a bit. Let's let, you know, a couple of households come together. But let's understand that mask wearing is one of the best defences we have to prevent infection spread, and keeping the distance and all those sorts of things. So it's about just trying to get, ever so subtly, the balance right when it comes to relaxing restrictions and relax them a bit more and a bit more. And all this is really just about buying us time to lift that vaccination rate. We just have to get as many people vaccinated as possible. That's what's going to keep people safe. And that, in the end, is what will get us to a point where we can all get back to something that looks as much as possible like life as normal. But we can't do that and continue to put a whole bunch of people at risk who are currently unvaccinated.
Well, but seeing that a lot of people are still confused by the numbers, even though it's been rolled out, well, it was announced a couple of days ago already, is it much easier to just stick to the original level three restrictions without throwing out more numbers to make things even more confusing?
Yeah, I guess the point we're getting to is when we look at some of the cases that were popping up and people's behaviours, is that willingness to comply with those restrictions is starting to falter. People are less willing to comply, so it's about acknowledging that and allowing some changes, some easing up of restrictions, however minor, that allow people to, you know, like they can see people from another household, they can meet together, ideally outdoors where the best ventilation is. But also understanding that we still have to keep a level of restriction in place if we are to minimise infection while we're still trying to get into that 80, 85%, 90% plus level of vaccination.
I want to now move on to other parts of the roadmap, particularly around schools. Why does Cabinet have agreed to reopen schools after the holidays and allow playdates between children, even those under 12 aren't eligible to be vaccinated?
Well, we haven't given final confirmation yet. We've signalled that that's what we would like to do. We'll make a final decision of that by early next week. But look, we know that it's been tough on teachers and on families to have to try and continue some form of education while based at home. But, you know, given that there isn't a kind of permission or authority to vaccinate those under 12 at this point, and they are typically at lower risk. I mean, if the international experience is that if children get infected, they don't get as seriously unwell as adults, and they tend to recover more quickly. So you have that. It is predicated on teachers, as many as possible being vaccinated and wearing masks and sort of minimising infection spread through those sorts of means. So again, it is about that, accepting that we do have to start, particularly this time of the year, trying to return to things as normal as possible, and that includes for young children's education as well.
But children could also be a risk of spreading the virus, is it not?
Yeah, so and the biggest risk is to the adults. So providing the teachers are vaccinated, and there's a debate right now about, you know, whether there should be a vaccine mandate for teachers. But maximising the number of teachers vaccinated, and frankly, every single teacher should be getting vaccinated. There should be no question about that, to keep them and others safe. And they should be wearing masks those are two very, very effective measures to minimise the impact of, and frankly, the risk of infection when it comes to COVID.
Okay. Well, the government announced that October 16 will be a national day of action for vaccinations. Do you think it can successfully boost vaccination rates to the levels that you want?
Well, we've seen in the past that when there's been a real focus and a big build-up to a particular, you know, defined period of time, that it does lift vaccination levels, or vaccination rates. And we've seen that actually just in the last few days, a heightened awareness of what it looks like when infection kind of starts to migrate into other places, and people see that the risk for them is greater. It's driving people to the vaccination centres. So this is a kind of a major push. There'll be a lot of focused attention on it, a lot of noise about it. And for those people who have been unsure of themselves, perhaps even a little fearful, we'll make sure that there's a lot of information out in the public arena over the next 10 days or so as we head towards that vaccination day. But this is a major push with a major focus on getting good information out to those who kind of instinctively might be thinking, maybe it's time for me to kind of get on and do this, or make up my mind, or really find the time to do this. This is really about trying to encourage those people to make that choice.
Does the government have a target on on the numbers that it wants to achieve by October 16?
There's a sort of informal target floating around of 90%, 90% plus. The reality is, if we get to 90% fully vaccinated population, that gives us a whole lot more choices about what we can do in terms of infection prevention and control than if we are at even 85% or at 80%. So that's why we are just saying push, 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 get vaccinated, get vaccinated, get vaccinated. That's what restores freedoms. And, you know, people want to have a great summer and go to the beach without having to think about it, going to Rhythm and Vines or any of those other sort of big outdoor events and close to each other, having a good New Year's Eve, having a good Christmas with extended family and whānau. You want to do all those things. The best way to do that without having to worry about it is not just for yourself to get vaccinated, but everybody you know to get vaccinated. There are very few risks associated with the Pfizer vaccine. Billions of people around the world have it. And it is our ticket to a safe and happy summer.
That was Labor MP Andrew Little.
The Wire.
Ko te Wire, tēnei marunga, irirangi poho. You tuned into 95BFM. This is the Thursday Wire, and that was Health Minister Andrew Little. It's 16 past noon here in Tamaki Makaurau, Auckland. We'll be having a quick break, but now here's some Mara Tike for you. Oh,
Shot team.
Shot pigeon.
Shot my G.
Shot everyone.
Yeah. It's our shot, Auckland. Get vaccinated today.
And let's get back to it.
Yeah.
The only thing more West than a baby in a Metallica onesie is coming home after a long, hard day and cracking open a cold book.
Going West Writers Festival is streaming ahead, bringing you Bibliophiles, a series of intriguing online events featuring characters pushed to the extreme at Dangerous Truths, Saturday, October 9th. Hearsay, survival stories at Behind the Blinds, Sunday, October 10th. And the world of Aotearoa genre fiction at Escape Rooms, Monday, October 11th. All events kick off at 7:30 p.m. and are absolutely free. Go to goingwestfest.co.nz.
Where in the world is Justin Wong? It's Overseas Experience, your international news update on 95BFM.
Welcome back. The centre-left Social Democrats in Germany and its leader Olaf Scholz are closer to forming a government 10 days after winning the federal election, as the Green Party and the Liberal pro-business FDP party agreed to start coalition talks. This also follows outgoing German Chancellor Angela Merkel's conservative Christian Democrats facing their worst electoral performance. Dr. Mona Kroll is a lecturer at Victoria University. I spoke to her on Monday and I began by asking how the election panned out for the parties.
So I don't think we really need an introduction to the electoral system. It's very similar to New Zealand's electoral system. Germany has two votes as well, one for a direct candidate and one for a party list. So everything, you can basically imagine it like New Zealand. So basically, I think the striking point of this election is, on the one hand, the comeback of the SPD, the Social Democrats, who under Merkel basically did not manage to get a foot into the door and did very badly. But now they have they are plus 5.2%, so they have really won back. They are the strongest parliamentary group now. They will have 206 seats. And the majority of Germans actually want their top candidate, Olaf Scholz, as the new chancellor, whereas the CDU post-Merkel did very badly. So they had the highest losses ever, 8.9% percentage points. They clearly lost the election. They might govern, though, depending on how coalition talks end. But they really kind of messed up during the campaign. So I think another pretty interesting point about this election is how the small parties did. They did very well, the Green Party and the FDP, and they might be the kingmakers now, deciding on which coalition will govern. Though the Greens definitely were kind of beyond the expectations in the end. Even if this was kind of their best result and a record result, they could have done even better given where they were standing in the polls before already.
Let's talk about the SPD for a second. Who is Olaf Scholz?
So Olaf Scholz currently is the Vice Chancellor and the Minister of Finance. So 48% of the Germans currently want him as a chancellor. I would say kind of he's a very pragmatic guy within the SPD, kind of standing very kind of centrist within the party, able to negotiate with both wings of the party. And he's kind of a very quiet guy who probably isn't the most charismatic candidate you could ever imagine, but somebody who kind of was simply the better alternative compared to what the CDU presented with Armin Laschet, who clearly was not wanted by Germans. Only 24% wanted him as a chancellor. And most Germans believe that the CDU would have done much better with Markus Söder, who was also competing for becoming the party's chancellor candidate, but did not make it compared to Armin Laschet. And I think Olaf Scholz's strength was really kind of a quiet but kind of solid campaign, whereas the CDU kind of was, their candidate was kept blundering along during the entire campaign from mistake to mistake. And that actually kind of helped the SPD. He's now much more favored by people than actually his party is, the SPD, Olaf Scholz. Yeah.
Let's talk about the CDU, CSU for now. Like you said, their votes dropped tremendously at this election. Could it be because of Angela Merkel leaving? So that's why the voters decided to not vote for them as well?
Yes. So part of this is definitely Angela Merkel leaving. She was always somebody who was favored even across party lines by people. So 60% of the Germans currently think that the void that Merkel has left won't be filled by anybody soon. Even SPD, Green, Left Party and FDP supporters think that not only CDU, CSU supporters. And so she was governing for so long that there was not really somebody that was kind of a natural follow-up candidate to her anymore and was seen as such. So I think probably her party is also not as favored by their voters anymore as it was in the past. People for years voted for Merkel, but not for the CDU. And I think this is becoming clear now. Now that the offer is not Merkel anymore, people are not voting for the CDU anymore. I think part of this is the story that she has social democratized the CDU in that grand coalition with the SPD over a long time and pushed the party to the left. But this is not necessarily something that the CDU-CSU voters want. They just wanted Merkel and liked her. But as soon as she was out, the party that she has left is not something that is kind of really attractive to voters. But I think a big part of the deal is also that Armin Laschet was a candidate who really did not do well in that campaign. So the CDU could have done better with another candidate, definitely.
And touching on the minor parties now, the Greens, the Green Party in Germany have their best results. Could it because of the issue of climate change getting more attention?
Yeah, interestingly, they had a record result, and so their best result basically ever, though they could have done a lot better. So it is actually the current result that they received is the worst result compared to the polls before the election since August 2018. So would Germans have voted on any other Sunday since August 2018, the Greens would have done better than they have been doing on election eve, exactly. So this is actually a disappointment for them, even if it was a record result. And they had a chance at a certain point to be the party that provides the chancellor and probably the strongest party. So they did not do as well as they could have done, which was also partly can be attributed to the campaign and probably their candidate, Annalena Baerbock, who did not do that well as a chancellor candidate. So this is one of the reasons. It is also actually depressing for them that climate change is now the most important problem in that election. So people even kind of placed it before the coronavirus as a problem to solve. Nonetheless, it did not help them as much as it could have helped them. It might have gotten them the record result, but it did not give them the chancellery, which was totally in the books before the election.
There's also one party I want to talk about is the Alternative for Deutschland, the AfD party. Well, their vote share at this election fell compared to the one last time, 4 years ago. Does it sound like it's only a sort of blip and they are on their way out?
It is hard to say if they are on their way out. I think this time there were certainly other topics that people cared about. During the 2017 election, they basically had the refugee crisis was a topic that people cared about, and they profited from that. This time there was no such topic. There were other topics that people cared about. The coronavirus was naturally something that only the government could tackle. And on the other hand, there was the environmental crisis, there's climate change. This was something that is clearly a topic of the Green Party. So they didn't have a kind of topic that would be seen as their competence issue that played into their cards and would have worked out for them. They are still kind of managed to stay in the parliament, in the Bundestag. This is surely a win for them. It could have also been over after the past 4 years for them. They actually kind of gained some ground here. But with parties like the AfD, you never really know how long they actually are going to survive there. They have a lot of internal struggles, and these kind of parliamentary groups can turn into a mess within a very short time period. I think they have lost probably a bit for not having that topic this time that kind of would have allowed them to gain votes. But on the other hand, they also kind of managed to stay in the Bundestag. The problem with the AfD is not fully solved yet just because they lost a few percentage points.
A quick touch on coalition options before we go. So there are several coalition options out there. The one that you mentioned earlier is the Grand Coalition. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yes. The coalition options which currently would have a majority are the Kenya Coalition, then the Germany Coalition, the Traffic Light Coalition, the Jamaica Coalition, and the Grand Coalition. So that all sounds a little bit confusing, to kind of explain that, the ones that actually of those that have a chance would be the Traffic Light Coalition, the Jamaica Coalition, and the Grand Coalition. And they are basically named after the colors of the party. So the SPD's color is red, the Greens Party's color is green, of course, and the FDP's color is yellow. So that gives you a traffic light, and this is kind of that gives you an SPD Green FDP coalition, and that is one of the ones that is the most likely. Same like the Jamaica coalition, which is named after the flag and the party's color. So that would be the CDU, the Green Party, and the FDP, because the CDU's party color is black. This is also one of the ones that is very likely. And finally, we have the Grand Coalition. These are the two big catch-all parties, the CDU and the SPD. Not as likely as the ones including the smaller parties and one of the big parties, but you cannot rule it out. Last time in 2017, they were also talking about the Jamaica Coalition for a very long time. Then the coalition talks failed and we ended with a Grand Coalition. So I would not fully rule out a Grand Coalition yet, though it's the least likely case. It will probably end with either a traffic light or a Jamaica coalition. Both are, I think, equally likely at that point. But it can still take a very long time until this is decided. So to give you an idea of the schedule, currently they're all still having bilateral exploratory talks. We are not even talking about coalition talks yet. So the SPD has bilaterally met with the FDP and the Greens, and same for the CDU, and both of the smaller parties, the Greens and the FDP, have met with each other. And the real coalition talks, they will start once this is sorted out. So currently they are still exploring if they in general could work together. Once there is a coalition on the table, the respective parties will have to sign off on this. So the SPD and the Greens already consider a vote by the party base, by the members, on a suggested coalition agreement. And it can still take very long, though the only fixed date is kind of the constitutive session of the parliament on October 26th. But they don't have to have a coalition by that time already. So the current government can still go on. Last time we didn't have a coalition before February, and the election was in September. So it could still be that for the next few months, you will see Merkel as a chancellor for quite a while.
Overseas Experience with Justin Wong, only on 95 BFM.
That was International Desk reporting on the German federal election. And here's a fun fact for you. I was born on the day of the 1998 German election in which the Social Democrats under Gerhard Schröder defeated the CDU and CSU. And almost exactly 23 years later, just one day off, I think, the same happened with Olaf Scholz and speaking. And now, while we're on the subject of elections coming back closer to home, the government has announced a review into parts of the electoral law that could see changes to voting age and parliamentary terms. The review would also look into overseas voting, party funding and certain aspects of MMP, including the 5% threshold for parties to enter parliament and the one-seat electorate rule. But issues like Māori seats, local elections and whether to change the electoral system completely from MMP will not be considered in this review. Justice Minister Chris Favoy said some of the larger changes, such as voting age and parliamentary terms, could go to a referendum. Dr. Lara Greaves is a lecturer in New Zealand politics at the University of Auckland, and I asked her this morning if she was surprised at what's being reviewed.
I'm not surprised to see the four-year term come up, because we saw Judith Collins and Jacinda Ardern agree on this in the News Hub debate in the lead-up to the last election. So that's one that's not particularly surprising. We've also seen the Electoral Commission over successive elections, several elections now, say that Māori should be able to change between the Māori role and general role more often. I think where I'm more surprised is them talking about the voting age change, because that's something that hasn't been very popular in polling. So that will be really interesting to see how that issue, the voting age, becoming more mainstream, how that might shape the public's perception over time.
Right. Even though Ardern and Collins mentioned they want to see longer parliamentary terms, do you think there is a public appetite of changing the parliamentary term and even changes being made to the voting age? Because Chris Favoy mentioned that changes to those two will likely be going to a referendum.
Yeah, we've seen the length of the parliamentary term lose at referendum a couple of times now over the sort of past 70 years or so. So I wouldn't be surprised if that's become quite a closely run thing around whether we should change 3 or 4 years. I think a lot of people have really good arguments on either side of that. And, yeah, power to them. It's going to be great to see a referendum on that, just because it means that we will talk more about constitutional issues. And I think a continued frustration of a lot of those working in politics and policy is sort of the lack of civics education, because we don't have it in schools. A lot of New Zealanders don't know about these things, so it'll be great to have a broader constitutional conversation. And the research has shown that referendums are really good for that, really good for having in-depth policy issues discussion. I think around the voting age one, that's going to be a really tricky uphill battle for the Make It 16 campaign and others. I think for a lot of us, we see or talk to some of the people that are part of that, that are 16, 17, or maybe just recently been able to vote. And they are amazing, articulate young people with awesome futures ahead of them. But I think ultimately what it comes back to on that issue currently is the public tend to think of themselves as a teenager, or they tend to think of like this some representative stereotype teenager who doesn't necessarily think about politics, or they tend to be concerned that they're just going to vote alongside their parents. So that tends to be like one of those anecdotal evidence type situations. I think at the moment the Make It 16 campaign has a challenge because it's viewed as a left-wing issue, it's viewed as a Green Party type issue, and I think that it needs to be just more generically viewed as something that would affect voters across the spectrum, because of course we know there are a lot of right-wing young people as well. So I think that that needs to be really taken out of politics and really looked at as an issue of sort of the cognitive ability of 16 and 17-year-olds. Personally, I've not seen a good reason to keep disenfranchising 16 and 17-year-olds. They tend to, any possible reason tends to apply to the electorate and those already enfranchised.
The review itself didn't look at the future of Māori electorate seats, but do you think there should be a change on the option to switch between the Māori and the general role?
I think for years we've been asking for that option to change. I think the Electoral Commission's been asking for years. The Māori Party has surely been asking for years. And a lot of people have thought that that's incredibly unfair, because at the moment, when we go to enrol to vote, people of Māori descent, we can choose between the Māori role and general role. And then we're stuck for every 5 to 6 years. So after every census, that's when we get the option. And it's only open for about 4 months, and they've got to post us out stuff in the mail. And there was a campaign last time with Stan Walker. But we don't get that opportunity to choose very often. The other problem is the terms have changed since the last time we got the option. So now Māori wards have been instituted in a lot of councils. So for some people, they chose to be on the Māori role or general role based on just the general election. But now, actually, they've got a local Māori ward. And they might not want to be on the Māori role for the Māori ward election, but they might want to be on the Māori role for the general election. Because we know there's a lot of complexity in how people make their choices. I think the go-to example there is often, if you're Māori and you're living in your Iwirohe, you're living where you're from, and then you like might move to Auckland, you just maybe don't want to be on the Māori role in Auckland. You might feel like you're voting in someone else's business. People have a range of reasons why they want to change, and they should be able to change. I understand that there's a lot of administrative issues there, though, so we wouldn't necessarily want someone to change the week before, because firstly, there would be a lot of sort of allegations of unfairness there and the potential to shift elections, and I think that that would be sort of quite populist debate that we don't really need to have yet. But also I feel for the Electoral Commission in that, because there'd be a lot of paperwork and we wouldn't necessarily then know the results on election night. And I don't want to see Māori be blamed for that. But I feel like they probably can quite feasibly put it in so we can change roles up into something like Rip Day, which is a couple of months before the election.
Just a final touch on the basics of MMP. Do you think, is there a reason for any changes to the party vote threshold or the one-seat electoral rule?
Now, we know that the Green Party in particular really like the idea of lowering the threshold to 4%. We see most elections in the polls leading up to the election that the Greens normally at risk of somewhere between sort of 4% and 6% at different points in the polling cycle. And so that tends to make, that tends to be like semi kind of self-interested and motivated on their part, because I think if you're lowering the threshold to 4% or even 3%, which the Electoral Commission has said that would be okay on balance, if you lower that threshold, the problem is you also are opening yourself up for more extremist parties on the right. So you have to think about, okay, so someone like Brian Tamaki, who is not very well liked in society, his party, could that party get to 2, 3, 4%? Is that a possibility? I think if you're a lefty and you are very probably, like, say, a lot of the Green Party social justice platform, you need to think about the flip side of that, is that the new Conservatives could get to 4%. So that's something that you really have to think about, that it's a both sides argument on that. Now, I think a lot of people have found it really unfair that if you get one electorate seat that you bring in people after you. The Māori Party have used that at the moment with Debbie Nade Wapaka entering Parliament. So the moment you win an electorate seat, you don't need to get to that 5% threshold. That's been something that's been recognised a lot as maybe ready to get rid of that and abolish that and move to a thing where we do have that 3 or 4% threshold, and that's the line that parties have to cross. I think a lot of people on the left, and I think a lot of people who are very pro-Māori politics, would not want to see that for the Māori Party. So that then becomes a thing around, do we have a different threshold for, say, like a registered Māori Party, or do the Māori seats operate differently? Because I think a lot of people would argue for having a Māori Party there to represent Māori interests. So that becomes a bit of a tricky debate. And I know around the start of the initial Royal Commission in 1986, did talk about the idea of there being sort of a lower threshold or no threshold for Māori parties. But I think generally, I think a lot of people have been feeling a bit uneasy around different deals in electorates. So the deal in Epsom, we can think back to, I think, 2014, and John Banks and John Key over the sort of teapot tapes and that conversation they had, that deal, the electorate deal being recorded. So I think people have felt that it has been quite unfair for especially ACT to get in based on the Epsom electorate and their deal with National versus other parties get to 4 or 5, close to 5% of the vote and not get into Parliament.
That was Dr. Lara Greaves from Auckland University talking to me about the government's electoral law review. Paul texted in saying he disagrees about referendums creating valuable policy discussions based on the recent cannabis reform. And don't forget, you can also let me know your thoughts on the text machine. The number is 5395, or if you want to call me, the number is 309-3879. It's 18 to 1 here in Tamaki Makaurau. We will be back after another break.
Yeah, hey, mate. Sign outside says you sell alarm clocks.
Take your pick, my friend.
There's just chickens here.
Organic alarm clocks.
That's roosters.
Ooh, PC police over here.
Start your day off over easy with the 95 BFM Wake Up Call. A smooth tune lovingly selected by Rachel herself every weekday on breakfast. The 95 BFM Wake Up Call. Thanks to Shaky Isles Coffee.
Wow, this one's very butch.
Tune into the Swap Meet this Sunday for a very special live session from Jakarta's Batavia Collective, a hot new crew with a single out on the Mighty R&S label. Expect only the very best kind of club-inspired jazz music. The Swap Meet Batavia Collective live session this Sunday from 4 p.m. only on 95BFM.
You call that a news update? This is a news update. It's Neighbourhood Watch.
This week on Neighbourhood Watch, Dominic Perrault has replaced Gladys Berejiklian as the new South Wales Premier. And I began with Radio Adelaide's Zoe Canandis on the circumstances behind Berejiklian's departure.
So Gladys Berejiklian, the new South Wales Premier, has resigned. Within this week, she stated that she'll leave Parliament. And this is after the state's anti-corruption watchdog revealed it was investigating whether she broke the law by failing to report the conduct of her ex-partner or ex-lover, as a lot of the media are phrasing it, that he was the Wagga Wagga MP Daryl Maguire. So just a little bit of history into this ICAC investigation. It flared up about a year ago, and it was in relation to Gladys Berejiklian's relationship with Daryl Maguire. There was going to be an investigation into their relationship and whether this was used in Daryl's benefit. So the investigation from ICAC involves, the centre of it really are two grants to two different organisations. So the Australian Clay Target Association in 2016 to 2017, which Daryl Maguire had championed, and the Riverina Conservatorium of Music in Wagga Wagga in 2018, and as I mentioned, Daryl was the MP for Wagga Wagga. ICAC has also announced it will be investigating whether the Premier's conduct involved the dishonest or partial exercise of any of her official functions, so essentially saying whether Gladys had used her power in order to get these grants, these associations, and in turn benefit Daryl and his, you know, parliamentary stance. So there is, the question mainly is whether Gladys, breached the public trust there, refusing to exercise her duty until we're going to find this out from the state's anti-corruption law. She's suspected on responsible grounds concerns or many concerned corruption conduct in relation to her conduct with Daryl Maguire. So it's a pretty heavy investigation. It was a very heavy realisation when this news came out last year. And obviously now ICAC have made this announcement that they will be undertaking this really intense investigation. And in turn, we've seen Gladys leave Parliament. It's interesting. Obviously, it's a really interesting time. We know, we've known for a long time, and all of you folks across the ditch know that the Delta variant is, really hit New South Wales really hard. They've been going through a really intense lockdown stage, and, to have a premier resign in the middle of that has been a really interesting upturn for the state and for the wider sort of Australian community in general. We're just all a little bit like confused about this scandal. So Gladys has announced she will be leaving. She said in her statement, that history is going to demonstrate that she executed her duties against the highest level of integrity, and she seems very steadfast in her conduct and is being very strong about that. But she's still, in the same breath, she's also resigning.
And just days after she resigned from as Premier and from Parliament altogether, New South Wales has elected a new Premier.
Yes, they have. So we are now seeing Dom Perrett, is the New South Wales Premier. He was the former New South Wales Treasurer. He's in charge now. And some background on him, I personally didn't know much about him, obviously living in South Australia. He's 39 years old, and he is one of 13 children, and he is a father of six children. In 2005, he was the president of the Young Liberals at Sydney University. I think it was 2015 or 2014, whenever Trump was being elected. 2016, I don't even remember anymore, apologies. He did show his support of Donald Trump in 2016 in a Facebook post with a very sort of conservative caption and sort of talking about free speech and all this stuff. So he's got this sort of tumultuous past there. He is a massive Catholic, very, very strong Catholic family, strong Catholic values. And he also said that everything that comes out of Australia is poor. That sort of statement has been rehashed as well since he's been elected New South Wales Premier. So yeah, a little bit of a tumultuous history here with this figure. He was obviously voted in by the party. This wasn't anything to do. There was no community votes here. We'll see what happens in the next election. But for now, he is the New South Wales Premier, obviously taking on a massive job, which is, you know, ushering New South Wales through this lockdown and trying to get back to, nothing's going to be normal again, but trying to get back to allowing New South Wales the community to be able to not have to fear the Delta variant. So we'll see how it goes. But it's been a very interesting uproar. I feel like I gave you a very basic crux of the situation there, but it's been a really complex and sometimes confusing situation here in Australia. A lot of Australian journalists have been feeling it the past week.
Do you think is the view coming out of Australia that with a new premier, the COVID strategy in New South Wales could change, or is it just more of the same?
Yeah, we haven't seen him make any really big drastic changes yet in terms of New South Wales' COVID plan. Who knows what he'll decide to do, but we haven't seen anything change drastically yet for New South Wales. They're still very much in lockdown and going through that. So, yeah, he hasn't really made any changes there.
That was Neighbourhood Watch. Ripper.
That was The Wire.
And that's all for the Thursday Wire for today, October 7th. Nē te mihi kia koutou katoa I kōrero me kia mātou mō tēnera. Thanks to those who spoke to me today, we had Health Minister Andrew Little, Radio Adelaide's Zoe Canandes, Victoria University's Dr. Mona Krill, and Auckland University's Dr. Lara Greaves. E whakarongo ana koe ki te irirangi pōho, you're tuned into 95BFM. Sigrid will be here for the 1 to 4 next, so don't just tune out just yet. Ka hoki mai mātou a te rawiki, I'll be back next week, and until then, stay safe. Mā te wā.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.